Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Avington Miller, Jr.
Hello and Happy New Year to everyone. And for those of you who are coming back for another year, you know I especially give you a hello and a welcome. And for those of you, this is your first time, we also welcome you here. We have a really big show. I've said that in the past, but we have 5 or 6 people that will be on the panel today. Hopefully we'll have people calling in because the issue that is so important and it's going to hopefully get the attention that it needs today, and this will be a kickoff for it to get front page coverage as we go forward. I think the best thing I can do is introduce Luciana, who is the special co-host for this show. She put it together, and I think she's probably the best one to introduce the rest of the panel and get us going. Happy New Year to you, Lucy.
Happy New Year to you, too.
All is well with you. Well, thank you.
Yes, all is going well.
As I mentioned, you put this show together, and so won't you give us a really brief intro of yourself, and then intro our guests and let them do a brief intro as we go.
All right, thank you very much. First of all, my name is Luciana Sampson, and I'm a teacher in Tennessee, public school teacher, and I teach English, language arts, British literature, and AP literature. I am also the president of the Franklin County Education Association, and I also work with Dr. Miller on the War Report. And as an individual, as a teacher, I also am very interested in learning disabilities, specifically ADHD, TDD, different types of LDs. I have dyscalculia, which is sort of a type of dyslexia, pattern recognition, which is probably best and in shorthand. My students that struggle with special needs and dyslexia, something near and dear to my heart, is dyslexia and the common core and how those things tie in together, how they work or do not work for the students with these particular needs. And also in Tennessee, which is where I teach the RTI intervention. So to speak to these issues, specifically dyslexia, we've got Dr. Kelly Sandman Hurley, a published author and researcher of dyslexia. She's also an adjunct professor of reading, literacy coordinator, and a tutor trainer. She is the past president of the San Diego branch of the International Dyslexia Association, as well as the board member of the Southern California Library Literacy Network. She's a professional developer of California Library Literacy Services, as well as a literacy consultant for the San Diego Council on Literacy. Kelly received Orton-Gillingham training by a fellow of the Academy of Orton-Gillingham Practitioners and Educationers and has been trained in the Linda Mood Bell Wilson Reading, RAVE-O, and Read Naturally programs. She was awarded the Jane Johnson Fellowship and the Commission on Adult Basic Education Scholarship. Kelly has presented at numerous conferences as well as provided professional development for teachers. She received her doctorate in literacy with a specialization in reading and dyslexia from San Diego State University. San Diego, and Kelly is also a co-owner of the Dyslexia Training Institute. Along with Kelly, I have Tracy, if I mispronounce your name, Tracy Bach Zaretsky, is that correct? Tracy Bach Tracy Bloch-Zaretsky. I'm hoping that I'm saying your name right. And you are a tutor of children and adults with learning disability. You've been doing that for the past 18 years. Tracy is a trained special education advocate, assisting parents and children through individual education plans and the 504 plan process. Tracy received Orton-Gillingham training by a fellow of the Academy of Orton-Gillingham Practitioners of Ed. She's also trained in the Wilson Reading System, the Linda Mutual Program's Reading Naturally, and a variety of reading and writing assessment tests. She's presented at numerous conferences on learning disabilities, phonetics, reading and writing instruction, as well as provided professional development for teachers. And she and Kelly are co-owners of the Dyslexia Training Institute. And a little closer home to me, here in my own home state, we have Jennifer Nagel, who's a certified dyslexia advocate and founder of the Dyslexia Spot. She's also co-president of SPEAK, which is Students, Parents, Educators Across Knox County. She's on the leadership team of the Tennessee Decoding Dyslexia Group. And we have Eileen Miller, who is a parent of a dyslexic child. She's also dyslexic herself. Eileen's credentials start with an overview training of the Wilson Reading Program, online dyslexia module class from Tennessee Center for the Study and Treatment of Dyslexia at Middle Tennessee State University, Susan Barton Screening for Dyslexia, online instructions in the scientifically based methodology from Reading Horizons, and the Dyslexia Advocate Certificate Program from the Dyslexia Training Institute. She's also a member of COPPA and IDA. She's a founding leader that started the Decoding Dyslexia Group in Tennessee in the fall of 2013. Eileen is the owner of Ignite Dyslexia Awareness Center in Franklin, Tennessee, that offers tutoring, screening, and advocating. Eileen's goal is to help inform parents as well as teachers so that they understand dyslexia and to debunk many of the myths out there about dyslexia. And with that, the end of my extensive introduction. Welcome to all of you. Thank you very much for being on the show. And let's go ahead and talk to Kelly, Dr. Kelly, a little bit first. Can you tell us a little bit about what dyslexia actually is and give us a little bit of background on that topic, please?
Dyslexia is a phonological processing problem. So, or deficit, I should say. And so what happens is when a person with dyslexia goes, attempts to decode words, mainly in isolation, they have difficulty attaching a phoneme to a grapheme in a way that is fast enough and rapid enough for them to be able to read it with some fluency and some accuracy in order to get comprehension at the same time. And it also affects spelling, which is usually an ignored part of dyslexia, but it's a lot of people with dyslexia can actually have normal to adequate phonological processing problems but have difficulty with the orthography, meaning that they have difficulty with just the spelling part. So something happened where they're able to verbally manipulate the language, but they can't translate that to the written part of our language.
So it's a visual perceptual issue in many cases. And there's lots of different kinds of dyslexia, right?
Well, no, we don't want to attach the word visual to it, because that can get misconstrued, and it often does. So we want to make sure that we're sticking to just the phonological. It's not that they see things any differently than people without dyslexia do, because they don't. They see things just the same way that people who don't have dyslexia do. The problem is that when they take in that information, they take in that grapheme, they don't know, their brain has difficulty attaching the correct phoneme to it in a timely manner to help them read it. So it's not that they're seeing it differently, it's that they're processing it differently.
Maybe if you could tell us what a grapheme and a phoneme, if you could explain those definitions, that would help.
Sure. A grapheme is a letter or a group of letters that represents a phoneme. So TH is the grapheme for, and B is a grapheme for B, and TI could be the grapheme for SH. So it's a letter or a group of letters that represents a phoneme, and a phoneme is an individual sound.
Okay, thank you very much. Sometimes it seems like things that might be commonplace that we all should know, we really don't have a clue about, so I may ask some pretty elementary questions to help clear things
let me come in
for our readers.
At this point, think of it like this in this conversation. All of you are very aware, knowledgeable, expert, a lot of experience, and we're having a conversation, but there's a problem. You're talking to the village idiot. That's me. Break it down so that the village idiot can understand it. So when you give letters, give the words, because people won't know what you're talking about when you shorthand it. And again, I think I'm a perfect example for you to have to visualize when you're talking, that you're talking to, you know, the village idiot, and you want to make him understand at the most basic level that you can drop it down to. And that's the truth. I am the village idiot on this. So go ahead. Talk to me.
So tell James what dyslexia is in the most base form you can imagine.
Okay. Tracy, maybe you're better at that than I am.
I think, can you guys hear me okay?
Yes.
I think that Kelly defined it pretty well in that it is a phonological processing deficit. I think what became the challenge is when we start throwing in that visual or auditory processing ideas into it, when it's really, it is the phonological, which is the sound structure of our language attached to the graphemes or the letters of our that represent our sounds in our language, and that people with dyslexia have, as Kelly said, a difficult time with accurately and fluently attaching the correct phoneme to the grapheme to put them together to get to a word. And they may be able to do some, but not all of them. They always can do some, but rarely can they do all of them and with accuracy and with fluency to a point to read well enough to get correct prosody to get to comprehension. Did that help?
I have to say yes, because then if I don't, I really will show my village idiot credentials. So I'm going to say yes.
Well, yeah, can I answer that?
I got it. Folks.
Is this
I'm
Eileen?
Joking.
This is Eileen.
Is this Eileen? Eileen, please.
It is Eileen.
Help us.
To make it real simple for dyslexics, it's really hard to get to the simple sounds of the word, not the sounds of a word as a whole, but the individual sounds. Does that help? So for someone who is dyslexic, they can say the word cat, but they can't break it apart into individual sounds as easily. So that is where breakdown is.
So it would be like a whole word learning opposed to phonetic learning.
Yeah, I guess when you're processing it, it's really hard for dyslexics to hear all the sounds sometimes in the word. So therefore, it gets really hard to spell and to sound out words because we don't hear the sounds the same way as everybody else does. It takes us a little bit longer to process them. Does that help?
So you might hear a CH blend as a totally different sound than it actually is, in other words.
Well, can I jump in and give you an example?
Yes, please.
Like when she said cat. So if you're testing a child to see if they have dyslexia, you would say, okay, say cat, and they would say cat, and then say, okay, now say cat without the k. Can they say at? And so it's can they manipulate the language?
Yes.
So if you say, how many sounds do you hear in the word catch? You want them to say k, a, ch. There are three phonemes in the word catch. So it's not that they're identifying the wrong sounds, it's that they're unable to pull them apart, put them back together, manipulate them, do sound deletions, just kind of manipulate the language verbally, which is why it's
and rhyme-
so easy. Go ahead.
And rhyming is very hard as well. Things like
yeah,
that.
It can be. Yeah, it's not the same for everyone with dyslexia. They all, I always call them snowflakes. They all look different, and they all come in with different, you know, they all their testing always looks different, but that can be a symptom. But, you know, they don't see B's and, as D's or P's as Q's or was as saw. They don't see that. It's just that they're having trouble doing that in a speedy enough way that it comes out as the correct word.
That's really interesting because it seems like so much of what we hear about dyslexia is not necessarily that.
Right.
So that's
why we're
like
here.
A great thing to know is how much of it is phonemic awareness.
And you know, they can have good phonemic awareness.
I'm sorry, what?
No, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, I'm done.
No. They can have good phonemic awareness as well and just have a disability in the area of spelling or just have really slow reading speed. So sometimes they have, you know, average phonemic awareness, but somehow it's not translating when they're looking at the written word or our English orthography.
Let me ask two questions. Recently, as I was doing my research getting ready for this, I ran across a number that said there are 25 million students / families that have learning disability issues. Is that number correct based upon your understanding of the field? When I say learning disabilities, it was speaking to what we used to call, and I don't know if we're still calling it special education, that population. And if that number is correct, my follow-up question would be, what percentage of that number are we talking about when we're speaking to dyslexia?
Well, the number that the NIH likes to use is 80% of special education is reading disabilities. And schools like to use the term reading disability or specific learning disability versus dyslexia, but most reading disabilities are dyslexia. So it's reasonable to say that 80% of that number, 25 million, I mean, I don't know. You know, it's the number for dyslexia is 1 in 5. And you have to remember that it goes from mild, moderate, severe to profound. So a lot of those, you know, seems high, but it's because a lot of the kids on the mild side are never identified.
So we are talking a large population.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's what makes it such a huge issue that is underrepresented in terms of media, in terms of politics, in terms of funding, and the whole education community concerned. We're talking
absolutely
about huge population here. And one of the key words I heard was that goes unrecognized.
Mm-hmm.
And if you follow that all the way through and take it into coming out of school, into the adult population, I think you can see very quickly 25, 30, 40, 50, 60, 100 million people maybe walking around with these unrecognized and moderately recognized and specifically recognized disabilities. Would that be a fair projection?
I don't know what you guys think about I don't know about the number, but I can tell you that Tracy and I did come to this through adult literacy, so they are walking around unidentified, and we saw it firsthand for 12 years at least. So yeah, I don't know about the statistic, but maybe somebody else has an opinion.
Well, the statistics for adult illiteracy, reading at or below the third grade level is 20% of the adult English-speaking adult population. So a lot of those do have undiagnosed learning disabilities.
Well, as I said, that would easily validate that 25 million number.
Sure.
That I found easily and quadruple it.
Yeah.
Most people don't have a clue about what we're talking about. I do know a little bit more than I said earlier in terms of the village idiot. Just say maybe I'm the neighborhood, not the whole village, just maybe the neighborhood idiot. And I know, personally and professionally, about the importance of this issue, both as in the education community and the general population. And I think, for me at least, our whole conversation boils down to a few basic questions. And for me, one of the first ones is that as educators and parents and general citizens, we all should be very concerned about this issue in the sense that we want to ensure that students with disabilities receive the most appropriate and education in the least restrictive environment that we can create. Would that be a fair general statement in terms of what this is maybe all about?
Well, I think the challenge is that our teachers, children do have that right, definitely, that all children should have the right to a free and appropriate public education. The challenge is that our teachers, whether they're gen ed teachers, special ed teachers, reading specialists, our school psychologists, our school administration, haven't been taught through their training programs what dyslexia is, how to identify it, and what to do about it. So that's what's causing the big issue here, is that the lack of education of our school staff about what dyslexia truly is and how to help kids that have it.
Mm-hmm. Anyone
it's
else?
Very difficult. As a teacher, I know I have learned throughout my years as a teacher, as an English teacher, to recognize students that are dyslexic by their writing, by their reading ability, and probably also because of my own specialty or ability. I like to call it my superpower rather than a disability, because sometimes I think it actually helps me work harder and strive to achieve more. But I think that if you read enough and pay attention enough and get to know your students, then you can definitely tell who has this through the way that they write and they can. Another thing that I found is when I do realize, many times students realize that themselves and they have no idea why they are struggling or feel like they're not able to do what some of their peers can do, then I just automatically go ahead and modify for their students and give them tools that help them possibly find some success where maybe they haven't had it before. And when an English teacher says to you, I want you to listen to the podcast, I want you to listen to the book, you don't have to read all of the book. It's like all of a sudden this light just goes on in their eyes because they're given a tool to help them and they're not going to just struggle. Or when I say, you know, I know you understand what's going on with this concept, why don't you tell me about it? And they can sit down and they can tell me about it and not have to necessarily write it out or struggle to read the question on the test. And so those are things that I found as a teacher that really help my students do well, that I can give them scores on. What do you guys think about that as parents and as specialists with dyslexia? Am I on the right path as a teacher?
Lucy, this is Jennifer. I just want to say that is exactly what we need with our teachers, but unfortunately, teachers aren't getting the training to know what dyslexia actually is. The teacher, my daughter's teacher right now, she has learned a lot about dyslexia because of my daughter and things I have shown her or had her read. And she can go back, she's been a teacher for 15 plus years, and now she can go back and say, oh my gosh, all these students that she had that she didn't know had dyslexia obviously did. She had no
right.
idea. And that's part of the problem right now, is that we're not training our teachers to look for the warning signs for dyslexia.
Right.
Because if they knew the warning signs, they could help their students like you're helping yours.
And see, the thing is, I teach all seniors. So by the time they get to me, I can recognize it because they've already established the way that they write. They've already established the way that their style, their tone, their voice, all of those things. If I were an elementary teacher, I don't know that I would be able to do that because
children learn at different levels, at different rates. They draw their numbers, and they, you know, my daughter's five, so right now I'm watching her go through the learning process. My son struggled horribly. He probably is an undiagnosed dyslexic himself, and he's ADHD as well, which has been diagnosed. So I've watched that from a parental perspective, which makes me very aware of my students to have the same type of teaching that I would want my own children to have, and I try to do that to the best of my ability. But I don't know how to do that on the lower levels. How do we do that for the elementary teachers?
I actually have had meetings, you know, in Knox County, Tennessee, with the superintendent and our head of special ed about we need to train our teachers. So they are actually working on some sort of, it's an online training, but, you know, I'm thinking baby steps here. We'll get there. But I've also actually done, Kelly and Tracy have come up with this amazing, it's a Dyslexia for a Day seminar, and I've done that in one of our elementary schools. And to see the teachers, I mean, it's eye-opening for them because they actually can, when they see what one of their students may be going through, and they immediately, when we do the first simulation, they immediately know the two or three kids in their class that are having that difficulty. And they all come up to me afterward and they say, thank you so much. Now I know I can help this child. And if we can do that for more and more of our teachers, it would make a huge difference in the elementary level.
Why aren't we doing it? Why aren't we doing it?
I don't have an answer to that. I don't know. I keep asking that question and I don't get an answer.
It's the universities are still reluctant to embrace the reality of dyslexia. And there is a lot of buy-in to whole language, which has absolutely no research to back it up. There's a lot of buy-in to the publishers that are publishing these books. And there is, it's fascinating that they're still really stuck on whether or not it even exists. And it's really unfortunate. And it's rampant. And it's really the university level that's really stopping this from happening. And so they're graduating people who are going in there to schools as administrators with the same thought process.
Mm.
That's my opinion.
I'm so tempted to add something that I wanted to wait to much later on in the conversation, but I'm going to bring it in right now. And that is, ladies, you're wrong. All of you are wrong. Duncan has said that Teach for America 5 weeks training makes them highly qualified coming to our urban schools where you have race, class, gender issues pertaining to learning and learning disabilities. And these 5 week semi wonders, they're the answer to it. So hence, I think unless you don't accept Duncan's I'm cracking myself up over here. announcement from on high, then we got a problem here because Teach for America, with 5 weeks of training, they are supposed to be able to come in and raise, quote, the achievement level of the most disadvantaged elements of our population, the 99%, based on 5 weeks of training. And universities who spend, what, 2-3 years to train and graduate programs and et cetera. So are you saying that the universities are not doing their job, but Teach for America in 5 weeks are doing it? You know I'm being facetious as hell.
So yes.
Yeah.
This ties into the Common Core issue that is also sort of a part of the show
now,
as well.
I mean, next, Lucy. I was going to have fun with that next.
And where does the Common Core standard help or hinder our students with dyslexia and our students with special needs, such as myself, such as my son, such as Eileen, such as Jennifer's child? Where does the Common Core fit into this? Where does the intervention, the RTI, where does that part of the curriculum, intervention, and special education, how does it all work together? And is that part of what what you guys are saying is because of staying in the way education, you know,
Lucy, you're breaking up on us.
Are those things, is that better? Can you hear me now?
I don't know yet, but you were, I didn't hear most of what you were saying.
Ah, it's living out in the country. It does it every time. Is that better?
Yes.
Okay. How does Common Core hinder what we're dealing with here with dyslexia and other specialties? Does it help? Does it hinder? I mean, I know my personal opinion, but I'd like to know from parent perspective and from Kelly and Tracy and Eileen.
I think Tracy actually got disconnected. She just emailed me and said she got disconnected. But in my very humble opinion, I don't think it matters what kind of standard you have. If they're not identifying these students and giving them the appropriate intervention, it doesn't matter how you're evaluating their progress. So it could be Common Core is really here nor there, in my opinion, because they still need the correct intervention. It really has nothing to do with standards. So if they're not identifying them in kindergarten, which they could easily do, and they're not identifying them in first, second grade, which they could easily do, it doesn't really matter, again, like I said, how they're evaluating them. Common Core has brought in a lot of writing, which can be more difficult for students with dyslexia, which means that accommodations need to be recognized more often than they did before. But again, it's all about the intervention and the early identification, which
well,
isn't
Kelly, and how are you going to do that?
Let me get this in. Kelly, you remember also part of the Common Core and PAR is technology driven. You don't write anymore. You click a mouse. So how does that even factor in?
There's a ton of writing though.
There is writing, and you know what's fascinating about that is we'll go to IEP meetings, and they'll say, which is individualized educational programs, and the team will say, they don't need to learn how to spell, it's not that important, they just have spell check. Well, I decided to test that theory because I happen to believe that teaching spelling is more important than teaching reading, and because if you know how to spell a word, you can read it, but if you can read a word, it doesn't mean you can spell it. And so I decided to test it, and I put a student's verbatim, what they wrote, in spell check, and it only found 25 to 30% of their errors. So they still need to learn how to spell. And if they can't spell, but they still have the thought, then they need to start looking at accommodations. And accommodations are really important while the student is getting an intervention. So they still, you know, there's more writing, and that's great. But if they're not teaching writing, it doesn't really matter. Again, it's about the intervention and the accommodations. And,
yeah,
you know,
and I have
a train of thought, but...
Yeah, and I have to agree with, 100% with Kelly, which, you know, 99.9% of the time I always do anyway. But, I mean, it's my own, with my own daughter, you know, she's absolutely right. And accommodations are more important now, but the problem is they're not very easy to get. Schools still don't want to do it. They don't want to give the accommodations for these kids. And simple
things. Explain accommodation.
An accommodation would be... like, my daughter's accommodations that she gets any test that they take, her teacher reads it aloud to her, so she doesn't read it by herself because she struggles with that. So when she takes a test without that read-aloud accommodation, it's not really testing her knowledge because she's struggling with reading it. She's going to do badly. But if the questions are read to her, that's actually showing how much she has learned on that particular topic because she can answer it verbally.
Right, which is... the accommodation that you do for students that you realize test better that way. That's part of what makes a good teacher, is knowing your students.
But unfortunately, a lot of teachers don't do that, and even I've been in IEP meetings as well where I actually had a teacher tell me no, that they wouldn't do it. And I said, why? I said, we're looking at this child, you know, possibly needing this for the state test at the end of the year. And if you're not doing it throughout the school year, they're not going to let her have it for the state test. And the principal finally jumped in and said, oh, no, you can definitely do that. So thankfully, this child is getting the read aloud. But for teachers, I mean, there are just teachers that just won't do it, or school districts that won't do it.
Why do you think that is? I mean, as a teacher, I could probably give some insight into that.
But why? As a parent, I have no idea. I have no idea. I looked at her, and I had no idea why she was so against it.
Did she not give him a reason?
Sorry, go ahead.
I would say it's because they're so unaware of what dyslexia really is and its impacts on a child's ability to be successful with independently reading and writing things, but that if they're given the opportunity to access the curriculum in a format in which gives them access, like in audiobooks or speech-to-text or text-to-speech, any of those things, and they can perform at grade level, some people think it's that because they don't know what dyslexia is, that if they just tried harder, if they focused more, if they were read to more, if they took school more seriously, they hear all these crazy things because they don't know what dyslexia is and that child really is trying the best that they can. They think maybe they're getting an unfair advantage if they give them the audiobooks compared to the other kids, which is not true at all. It's making the playing field even. And so it all goes back to the lack of training for teachers. And like you're a good teacher. You want to help your kids, and many teachers want to. They just don't know what they're supposed to do to help these kids.
Well, I think part of it, as from a teacher's perspective, is not necessarily that they don't want to help or.
Lucy, we have lost you. We've lost you.
Can you hear me now?
Well, I can hear you now, but you're going in and out previously.
Better? I'm having storms where I live, so that's probably affecting my signal.
I would imagine.
How is that?
That's much, much better. I've put out some questions, but the rest of you, do you have questions? You have points you want to get in here? Because if not, I've got some more questions to lay out.
Well, my favorite topic currently is RTI. And I'm
right,
very sarcastic
right
now.
What is RTI?
It's response to intervention. And Eileen is actually way more knowledgeable on it than I am, but... RTI is now the way that we identify kids with specific learning disability through special ed. So in the reauthorization of IDEA in 2004, a couple things changed. One was states were no longer required to use the discrepancy model. Okay, and then states were allowed, it's not required, but it is allowed to use the process based on children's response to scientific research-based intervention. And then the states were also allowed to use alternative research-based processes for determining SLD. So with those changes, in 2006, the federal regulations required all states to develop their criteria for specific identification under this RTI plan. And what has happened, in my opinion, is since there is such a lack of understanding from state to state regarding SLD criteria, we kind of have this unclarity in the federal regulation. So states are designing their own program, and now we have this approach that is different state to state, and it can vary state to state and district to district, unfortunately. And if you look at kind of the SLD category, it has declined since that reauthorization. And they had put out a memo, the Office of Special Education Programs, saying that RTI cannot be used to delay or deny an evaluation for special ed. So we're kind of in this RTI framework to identify these kids. And I think RTI is a great thing if districts put in the time and the money and the training. However, I don't think that a lot of states are really put in the effort and the time for these things to really work correctly. And I know we have hit upon it before. There is so much lack of teacher training on dyslexia. So you have kids in RTI, but the teachers aren't trained in dyslexia, so they don't really know what they're supposed to do with these kids. And the funny thing is, in my opinion, the response to intervention is determining who gets into special ed. But there's no universal definition of what responsiveness is. So we just kind of have this new system that I'm not so sure is very well thought out at this time. I mean, people can jump in as well. And the other problem I have with it is we're not finding the twice exceptional students, the kids who are very bright, but let's say they're making, you know, B's and C's. They're not really getting caught by the RTI system because they're not falling low enough below. So there's just a lot of issues I have with RTI. I think some may be doing it better than others. I know in Tennessee it is an issue from what I have seen with parents. And just, you know, but I'm sure others can talk about their state as well and how well it's working. But I just think they get caught in the RTI loop. They don't get out of it. They're not being identified. Parents can request an evaluation at any time through RTI. They don't have to wait till they're through all the tiers. And unfortunately, a lot of parents are told differently, but they do have the right to request that evaluation. But, you know, I don't know if that's really being conveyed to the parents.
But unfortunately, so, in Tennessee, they can request the evaluation, and my district specifically will do the evaluation. But we have been told by administration that until, even if they can see that there's a problem, the child still has to go through the three tiers, well, two tiers, before they can offer them special ed.
Mm-hmm.
And that
right.
just is so unbelievable to me.
It's against
right.
child fine, truly. It truly is against child fine. So, so that's just my take on RTI and this new. There's an interesting article out there. It's called The Blurring of Special Ed and a New Continuum of General Education Placement and Services by Dr. Douglas Fuse. I'm sure if you Google it, you will pop it up. And it really talks about the mindset behind RTI. And I just thought it was very fascinating to kind of see why we are at this point and where we go from here. So that might be something that if people want to pull up, that would be a good starting point to get some background knowledge.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I heard some laughter in the background there, so I think there's people who have something to say, who want to say what you were saying was being very diplomatic and polite, but an understatement. So chime in, everyone.
No, that was me. I only say it because Eileen actually is my advocate for my daughter, and I. So she, when she said that, she knew why I laughed because she was being very polite.
This is not a polite show. We're cutthroat. We go straight to the heart of the matter, and we call out people, places, things, events, and et cetera. And we do it in such a manner to let the world know that they're bad people or bad action, bad ideas. No, they're not bad. They're stupid. And so don't hold back. Go for it.
Right. This is a very democratic place where you can express yourself freely and we can have conversations and feel free to rant. And or support that with your facts and also some of your experiences and your personal narratives, which of course are very valuable. And in my opinion, what you've experienced is obviously what you know is reality within the school
correct.
System.
And with you know, with that I wanna get in and say some things too, and I said I had some questions here. When I was in school and I'm going to stop right now. Lucy, no, I did not know Moses. I had nothing to do with the Ten Commandments. And yes, I did have T-Rex as
tests. I'll cop to that. But other than that, Lucy, no, I'm going to I'm Team Tyne. I'm telling you that. I did not know Moses. Now, when I was in school, all the things everyone has said so far were acted out daily. Even when I was in kindergarten, and I've been thinking about this for the last few days, that cracks me up. When we started the school, I'm from Detroit, and in Detroit we had big brick structures, 2-3 floors, what have you. On the top floor of our school, and most of the schools, they have what they call open air, classes, open air, whatever. And the thing that was so creepy was that you could walk to school with your friends, and when you got into the building, those who went up to the top floor, the open air section, you never saw them, you never heard from them again until school was out. It was so scary. No one wanted to end up in the open air class. I'm kindergarten, I'm 5-6 years old type thing, and I've never forgotten that. It was the most frightening thing. Throughout my school years, public school years, and my early teaching, I ran into what we now call special ed issues. And I want to ask this question. Are behavioral issues in the classroom that lead to students being singled out, put into discipline programs, put into what for a while they were being thrown into special ed like crazy. That was the basket for any and all kinds of disruptive behavior, or perceived disruptive behavior as well as the actual disruptive behavior. What we're talking about here today, is that still happening? Can you talk about lack of assessment, lack of diagnosis, but yet still, we still have a whole lot of people who are being put on medication, behavioral problems, who are being identified as troublemakers, and et cetera, and pushed into some form of treatment that could fall under special education. Am I anywhere close to describing what is still going on today like it was going on in my time?
As a teacher, I'll just answer that. I think that that's changing with the response to intervention that we see happening now, and with students not being able to get the special education referrals that they need to get in some ways. And I have seen that change within the past 10 years as a teacher. So there are, yes, it's still there, but at the same time, I honestly think that the response to intervention is something that is starting to make that, starting to change that. And also the Common Core is something that is supposed to standardize everyone. Remember, we're not supposed to need special education under the Common Core standard. So we're really stuck between a rock and a hard place here, aren't we?
Well, I think, though, a lot of the, not all, but a lot of students that do act out in class, you really need to watch when they're doing that. A lot of kids, the teacher is saying, okay, we're going to read aloud and go up and down. You know, you might have that one child that's going to start acting out, so he doesn't have to read. He'll get sent to the principal's office or get to the corner because he doesn't want to read aloud because he struggles with that. So a lot of times, the children that do, or all of a sudden have to go to the bathroom, stuff like that, very fidgety, things in that nature, it's because they are afraid or scared to do that particular reading out loud or answering, you know, questions that are going around the room, anything that they know. My daughter this year is in third grade, and she actually self-advocated for herself and told her teacher, please don't call on me to read aloud. But if I have to, can you tell me what I have to read before so I can practice?
And I was so proud of her for doing that. But a lot of kids don't do that. They just will start acting out so they don't get called on.
I did it.
I think, right.
No, truly, I did it. I acted out.
You when still act would, out.
I know. But literally, I remember vividly the third, fourth, fifth grade, and our elementary went to sixth grade as well. I would try and see how much the teacher was asking each student to read so I could figure out where she would have me reading. So I would try and start practicing it, even asking someone by me, you know, what this word was and da-da-da-da. And if I couldn't get it together, I would ask to go to the bathroom. I would act out.
Right.
And have her have me stand outside. Then, you know, she would just say, stand outside, or the equivalent to time out, you know, go sit in the corner. Other than that, I was a straight-A student, got great marks. We called citizenship, behavior, I think. But I never, what I thought then was, we never learned phonics. Phonics was considered to be passé when I was in elementary school. So I'm a sight reader. Fortunately, I have an excellent memory, so I can remember most things. But in terms of being able to do it phonetically, no. To this day,
I would say, James, that you probably are dyslexic and don't realize it. And, of course, I'm not an expert, but just from our correspondence together and the written work that I get from you, that would be my teacher diagnosis. But, of course, that means, you know, I don't know exactly what that means, but I would say that probably. And I have a learning disability as well, and I tell my students that. I tell my students at the beginning of the year, I have dyscalculia. I tell them what it is. I tell them that I have trouble with spelling, and we all get a big laugh out of the fact that I'm an English teacher and I teach AP Lit, and I have trouble with spelling. And I tell them that I need their help and that I have this, and you know, it's just a thing. So they'll have to help me, and we're all in it together, and we learn together. And I find that when I tell my students about my dyscalculia and when I talk to them openly about these things, it relieves so much tension for any of my students that might have dyslexia or dyscalculia, or they're not good with English or reading or writing. All of a sudden they're like, oh, it's okay to be me in here and not be perfect and to not do well. She's not going to fail me. She's going to help me. And I find that that's a very liberating way to learn with my students. And I wish that any teacher that had a disability or that had a child that had some type of learning disability or anything like that, I think if more teachers did that, then the classroom would feel safer. But that's just me. That's how I roll. So, I don't know. What do you guys think?
I think any time you can take away the stress, you're better off because there is no learning happening when kids are stressed.
Not at all.
Right. So if you can make a safe environment, you'll have better results.
And testing does not create a safe learning environment, especially over testing and standardized testing with lots and lots of reading and lots of writing for lots and lots of students that struggle with these issues, especially ones that are undiagnosed.
I'll go back to my question in terms of, well, one way of putting it is like, why are so many minority students in special education even today? Is it really an issue of bad behavior, or is it an issue really more related to disabilities that are undiagnosed? Because I think if you know, when we look at the research and look at the literature,
overwhelming majority of students who are, quote, in special ed or learning disabilities are minority students. And they also
English language learners,
poor.
Yes.
They are poor and English learners. And so many of those students are male. And the question, at least for me, and I think for many others, comes is, what's going on there? I don't know what the numbers are in terms of the percentage of that 25 million that I mentioned earlier are minorities, but I would imagine it's way more than 50%, because this is, quote, it's an urban issue. That's where the largest education population is, a student population is in urban centers. And in urban cities, you have the minorities, and hence you have what the police use to explain high crime rate. And so, well, it's high crime rate because the people who are committing crime. There's this
Hey, James.
Yes.
I believe that we've got a couple people who are trying to call in to talk about this, and I can go off and free up a line. We've got Nancy Bailey and Joan Grimm, I think, that want to say something, but they can't get through line one. So I don't know.
Why don't I go off? Why don't I go off? I'm the village idiot here, so why don't I go off?
No.
Let you stay on and run the show from here. So,
you know, Tracy got disconnected, so she might have an open line there.
Okay, both Joan and Nancy are saying that they cannot get through. So I don't. Right.
I just don't know. I'm trying to do the best I can. I don't know if I can do any better. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, would it be easier
if take my line? Take my line and let Nancy and company come on.
We are attempting to have some callers come into the show to address James's question about minority students in special education, and we're having some technical difficulties. And I honestly don't have an answer to that question, so I'm really hoping that we can get some folks to call in and speak to that. If any of you that are on now, if you would like to address that question. You have a line to call in?
Yes.
Open?
Yes.
Excellent. Excellent. For our listeners right now, we have a line open. If you would please call in, that would be wonderful. I'm hoping that they will give us a call here shortly. Dr. Kelly, do you have any insight into James's question? Are you still with us, Kelly? Can you hear me? Hello?
I can hear
Anyone?
You. This is Jennifer.
Hey, Jennifer, is it just me and you?
No, I'm here still. Eileen's here.
Okay. Eileen's here. All right. Jennifer, Eileen, what do you guys think? Let's talk about this. I honestly don't have an answer to that question, but what do you think?
First of all, I don't teach in public school, so I really can't really address that issue. All I know is poverty, you know, magnifies every problem. So is it a real problem? Absolutely. But I can't really sit here and justify the reasons because I really don't have any answer. I don't know if Jennifer has any insight as well.
I know. you know, I don't know. Things I've been told, you know, the reason why we have RCI is because there's too many kids that were in special ed that really didn't need to be, and that's where, right. You know, RCI came about by to kind of get the numbers back. You know, I have mixed feelings about that myself. You know, I would agree that that's an issue, but...
Hello?
Hello, this is Joan Grimm.
Hey, Joan, thanks for calling in.
Lucy.
So glad you can get
Hi.
Through. You know Jennifer Eileen, I think.
I do.
I don't know Eileen, but I know Jennifer. Well, my name is Joan Grimm, and I've been teaching in Knoxville for, oh gosh, almost as long as you have, Dr. Miller, as you've been teaching, Dr. Miller. Oh, he's not on. And I taught special education for 24 years, and now I'm at the university teaching special education. And but I have a question more generally for everybody regarding kids with dyslexia, particularly the children with, you know, the mild dyslexia or the mild learning disability, reading disabilities, in the wake of high-stakes testing, do you see a higher number of students that are having lots of difficulties with the test or failing? Uh-oh.
Hang on, Dr. Miller.
Something.
Hello. There we go. Dr. Miller, you're also part of the conversation now.
Okay.
Joan,
yes. Did you hear my question?
I did hear. Joan, and you probably already know what my answer is going to be on this. but for me, I don't think, you know, it's not catching. I mean, it's showing that there's a problem. The testing, but what's happening is that the schools aren't actually acknowledging it and saying, okay, yeah, here's an issue, let's fix this. They're acknowledging it, but they're not fixing it because of RTI.
Joan, ask that question one more time, because Dr. Miller just came back in with us, and I'd like for him to hear it as well, and I need to reprocess that question, if you don't mind.
Right, no problem. Okay, I was thinking specifically about the high-stakes testings like the end-of-the-year TCAPs and the testing that is being given to kids, like in the third grade. They're not allowed to be promoted if they don't pass the test. And, of course, now we've got the 10 core and the Common Core assessments. I was just wondering...
This number is the only other number available to Station 1. I know you're getting lots and lots of people calling, but they're all calling Station 2. We'll never get through calling Station 2.
Give me the number.
This is Station 1. That's what I thought. Okay, I'm sorry. I got interrupted. Okay. Hello?
Yes, this is the only line that's available for Station 1 is the 888-627-6008 number. Or you could also give out this number, which is line 5, which is 530.
530.
487.
487.
1013.
Okay, got it. I'm putting it out there. All right.
Okay.
Give me that 888 number again.
Okay. I keep hearing a lot of different conversations, so I'm not sure who I'm talking to.
Nobody will have heard.
Okay. Am I
back into the conversation?
You are.
Okay.
And we were talking about...
There's a number that I'm going to give out. It's 530-487-1043. That number will get you onto the show.
Should I hang up and call that? Because I think I'm getting...
No. No, you stay where you are,
okay.
Barbara, I know.
Okay, because I can hear all the instructions to you, and so I didn't know if I was... I was wondering what the effects of the high-stakes testing, like the tests that teachers are giving children at the end of the year, and what that effect is having on children that already are having difficulty reading, and if it's making them feel more like failures or not. That's my question. Are more children having difficulty with those tests?
Yes, definitely, as far as far as what I've seen as a teacher, I know that the tests are going to become more difficult. I've taken the sample test. I've trained on the TARP tests, and I've trained on, of course, all the Common Core standards, and then the materials and things that are aligned, the curriculum that are aligned with those standards, and I've taught all of the different levels of writing at the high school level for those things, and I've seen what happens. I know many parents with students in elementary who are very frustrated with the new math curriculum that goes along with the standards, that are frustrated with the Pearson Reading Street program. And of course, really for me, this all comes back to let's follow the money, because these tests, they're not to benefit our children. These tests are simply to make money for the testing companies and to make money for the Achievement School District so that the charter authorizer can come in and take our schools and take our children and basically make everybody common. So, of course, it benefits them to make it harder so that our students are labeled as failures. Of course, it benefits them to not have any type of intervention for them or special accommodations for them. In my opinion, if they make everything common, then they can put everybody in their little paths and they can take over all the schools. And we've already seen that in Memphis. They're fighting that in Nashville. So, yeah, the tests are horribly hard and especially developmentally inappropriate for many of the elementary school students that are learning on different levels and at different speeds for their own development. So, yeah. They're awful in my experience as a teacher and as a parent.
Thank you.
I hope that helped.
That did help. I was just curious, too, if Jennifer or any of your other guests had any experience with their students with the pressure from these tests.
For me, my daughter, she hasn't taken the TCAP yet, but she took what Knox County had was called the SAT 10 test, and she took it twice in first grade, beginning of first grade and end of first grade, and did poorly on it both times, clearly showing she has a learning disability. The teacher, actually, it wasn't the test that put her in an intervention. It was her teacher that said she needs an intervention. Unfortunately, though, she was in the same intervention for 2 years, not making any progress. So, you know, I'm completely against these tests because the schools are not using them for the purpose. I mean, if the purpose is to find out which children are the ones that are struggling, and, you know, what was said in Knox County about, no, we're not waiting until third grade to find out our children aren't reading at third grade level. Well, guess what? My daughter hasn't been reading on level. She's in third grade, and she's reading on a first grade level right now. And the signs were there since she was in kindergarten, but no one listened to it.
Right, because it's subtle, right? And dyslexia, I might be wrong, but some of those phonological issues are harder to pick up when children are younger. And specifically with a very standardized curriculum that they're forcing people to do, forcing teachers into, I think it gives them a lot less flexibility in some of the strategies they can use. But that's just my opinion from what I've seen.
Yes, and I agree with you with the strategies because that's my one problem with Common Core. It's not – Common Core and RTI really don't work well together, I keep saying. RTI is supposed to be a little bit more individualized, not as an IEP would be, but it's more of a smaller group, but there's just no time for it right now. And my daughter is in a Tier 3 intervention, but she's also – so she's doing the general ed Tier 1 reading, which is completely different than what her Tier 3 intervention is. So they don't even go together, you know, and that's a problem.
Right.
She's literally wasting 90 minutes of her day, you know, and she's not able to. I mean, my daughter can read. She's just, she can't read at the same level as her peers.
Right. One of the things that when the state decided to
mandate that all of the state of Tennessee would use RTI. One of the things that some of our faculty members did was send them a letter and saying, we don't think that the state or the teachers are even ready for response to intervention as an eligibility criteria because, well, there's just a lot of different reasons. One, of course, is what your other guest said, is it's really tough to scale up. And the other thing is I don't think they're going to be able to get what we call fidelity on it. We're not really sure if teachers are using research-based practices. The different populations of kids in different schools look different from school to school and district to district, so it's hard to know. Is the lower 10% of students in one class the upper 10% of kids in another class in another county? I mean, that's kind of the way you pick kids in RTI to see how they go into the different tiers of intensity. So it's a dilemma. They rushed through it, and I think behind this is that we went to the state training last summer, is the state people in Tennessee really, really think that if RTI is instituted across the entire state, that the number of students identified in those moderate learning disabilities categories are going to drop. They are convinced that we're going to have fewer kids identified with learning disabilities.
Oh, absolutely, I mean, especially in the state of Tennessee.
They said that, and I really think that we're going to see an uptick in identification in other areas, particularly other health impairments, which is a lot of the times kids with ADHD get categorized as that. So I think they're... I don't know. We'll see. But I feel bad for the kids that are having to kind of be experimented on while they're trying to figure out how to do this across the state.
Yes, and that's exactly. Reading the article that Eileen mentioned earlier, the blurring of lines, and reading a lot of his work, Dr. Fuchs' work, actually made me cry because my daughter is in the middle of all of this experimentation, and.
Well, the Fuchs have been working on this. Yeah, both he and his wife have been, the Fuchs have been doing the RTI research for years, and that's what's so ironic about it, is that RTI is supposed to be a general education program. It's supposed to be instituted by the general elementary teachers, but all of the research is coming out of Vanderbilt in the special ed department, in the Fuchs. And they've done a lot of extensive research, but they haven't done as much research in high school. And even in middle school, all the research has been done in the elementary grades. So, I mean, it just was not ready to be scaled up. But I do think that the curriculum-based measurements about what kids are doing, if they're done correctly, give you better information about how the child is doing reading-wise than, you know, these kind of large-scale standardized tests, because there's so much gray area in those tests.
I think a teacher, my opinion on all of this is that a teacher knows a student who's struggling better than a standardized test ever will show. That's what teachers
are doing.
And we're not using the teachers. We're not even using that expertise any longer. And that's wrong.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's a dilemma. Well, I don't know if I have any other questions. So I'm just really worried about students with learning disabilities and all of these high-stakes standardized tests and how they're going to feel about school when they get out, because those are the very students that we want to enjoy school and enjoy reading. But I'm not queen of the world, so I can't make classes smaller and give teachers more planning time. So,
mm-hmm. Joan, you and I need to go do lunch sometime soon.
Yeah, I already have to ask you some. I already have a favor to ask of you.
Okay. Call me.
Are you and I the only two people on the radio, Lucienne?
No,
I'm still here. Oh, good.
The Joan and Jennifer show.
We'll talk through California about when we want to go to lunch.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to hang up now and let somebody else get through. Thank you.
So who do we have on? We've got Lucy's here, and we've got Jennifer, and we have Eileen. Dr. Miller, you're back with us. I'm back, too.
Okay.
So we're all back together again.
Did you guys miss me?
Yes. You know what? this is a conspiracy, and it's Bill Gates and Arne Duncan's fault.
I sure wish that was true. But let me explain to everyone what's happening. We have a fantastic network in that they have great capabilities. Normally, their max is to have 5 lines open and going at one time. We have exceeded that from the very beginning. And so there's a backup plan where they go to Skype lines. Well, that, I think, ran into trouble because of having trouble with their internet service line. And because of that, that line was unstable. So with people trying to call in, and I understand from network that we had a lot of people trying to call in, but they were unable to let them in because their backup service, the Skype service, was not available because they were having trouble with the line that allows for internet service, called a T1 line. And so we were really overwhelming their capacity right now. That's why I volunteered to drop out, because I thought it was much more important for the 5 of you, the 6 of you, and anyone who wanted to call in, like Nancy, one of my favorite people, Bailey, if she's still there listening, to be able to call in and have the discussion, because you guys are much more knowledgeable than I am. Apparently, me dropping out, and then I think Lucy dropped out, and then other people...
I got cut off.
Okay, what have you, so...
I didn't try to leave.
So... That's why it was down to 2 people, and so now I'm back, and Lucy, you're back. I don't know who else is still there. So we...
I think Jennifer and Eileen are still here. Jennifer, are you still here?
Yep.
Okay, and I think we might have lost Kelly and Tracy.
Kelly and Tracy, okay, so I would love to be able to blame...
I think Kelly and Tracy only had an hour anyway, so... Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
I would love to be able to blame Obama, Duncan, Gates, Koch brothers, the Waltons, you name it. I would love the latest.
I'm going to blame them anyway.
Okay, I'll go with that.
Because I can.
I'll go with that.
There's drones up there. They killed our internet. I'm telling you, this stuff happens to me because they're on to me. And they want to silence my voice. It's true.
I'll go with that. I'll go with that. Now, let's get to... I'm hoping some people can still call in, but if not, let's go with the conversation in this direction. I would like for us to go back to the larger issues here. In terms of, for example, the media, are we getting attention from the media in terms of, this is a huge problem that affects a huge portion of the American population?
Mm-hmm.
I don't see a lot of attention. So what do we need to do to get attention?
I do think the grassroots effort from Decoding Dyslexia is starting that movement. At least I have seen a little bit more awareness. Tennessee is starting to push a little bit more of dyslexia laws. So it is starting. Is it where it needs to be? Absolutely not. But I do think the grassroots way is the way to make the change happen. There is not a lot of media. Sometimes the media that's out there is not factual of what dyslexia is. So we're still having the debate of kids seeing things backwards, which is not true. So there's still that element of education that still needs to be done, that needs to be mainstreamed. Just general population, you know, awareness. So I do give a lot of credit to Decoding Dyslexia and their effort to pull this mainstream. You know, I don't know if anybody else has anything else to add.
Would we do better if we went to
special ed issues and all of the rubrics under that broad category of special ed, the behavioral disruption, all the things that are there, would that help in terms of bringing the public attention to it? Just focusing on dyslexia, which, as we established early in the conversation, may be 80% of the population that we're talking about,
right,
which is
right,
super huge. But who knows what dyslexia is? It's a word that most people can't pronounce, and most people don't have any clue when we start talking about, oh, people read backwards. That's what the problem is. So my thing is, we need to, as educators, as parents, we need to make this part of the war and our resistance to it, and then mount a campaign that will not only stop the negative that's coming out of the corporate state government coalition aimed at destroying public education, but to mount a resistance that has as its goal the defeat of those forces. And that's going to take millions of people waking up and getting involved. So how do we do, what do we do? And first of all, do you agree with me on this? This is a big issue thing, and I'm a big issue person.
Right. It is a big issue. There's no doubt about it. And it has to be hit on a lot of different surfaces, and that's probably the issue. It's not as simple as one may think to change this around. So you have funding issues. The problem is schools can't fund. If they would identify all these kids and put them in special ed, how are they going to provide services for all these kids? So it's not easy, you know, one, two, three, I can get this done. So I know that the Yale Center is doing a lot of promoting what dyslexia is and has done that for a lot of times with Sally Say, which, you know, and Ben Foss has got a new book called Empowerment. So there are some leaders out there trying to get the word out and get the right message. I also think that we need to get rid of the negativity around the word dyslexia. There's a lot of gifts with it and a lot of good aspects, and I think if we can change the mindset of teachers and everyone involved that just because you're dyslexic doesn't mean that we have to write you off. I mean, you have great talents, and we need to get that message out that this is okay. I know that here in Tennessee, Jennifer has been to a couple workshops that have been very positive for her child. And I don't know if you want to talk about that, Jennifer. People stepping up, adults owning dyslexia and saying, you know what, I have it, it's okay. You know, and just being a very great light for young kids and mentoring these young kids. Would you agree, Jennifer? Are you still there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that just brings back the larger issue of reading in general, and what James was saying about special ed and our minority students and our at-risk students and English language learners. And I want to just sort of talk a little bit about how, if we are all being sort of standardized and if our public schools are being taken over, especially in our urban areas, and we do have this sort of school-to-prison pipeline or population, then that's a real risk. And that is not only taking us further from teaching our students how to read and be well-educated so that they can think for themselves, it's setting them up for a system of basically enslavement all over again, and it's class warfare. And, of course, the people that are going to be affected the most at first are going to be our minority students, our English language learners, and our students that fall between the cracks, our students that don't have a lot of money. And we really have to look at it from a financial perspective as well. And so, Dr. Miller, I think that was something that you had asked, and then we got cut off, and so I'm trying to sort of bring it back to that topic. Is that what you were asking earlier?
Precisely. And you connected the dots beautifully there in terms of if a child is dyslexic or has a learning disability and it's not recognized, that child becomes, quote, labeled a disruptor, and under no excuses policies.
Right. The zero tolerance policy.
Zero tolerance policy. They are labeled, treated that way, and then put into that pipeline that you mentioned that we're going to do a show on at a later point in terms of the school-to-prison pipeline, and then from prison, the downward spiral of now you have a record and that's reason for people not to hire you. You go further into the rabbit hole that leads to becoming a disposable person in terms of what the corporate neoliberalism model is aiming to establish. So we take it all the way back to the kindergartner.
Yes, and preschool.
So for me, the advocate and the activist is we need to mount a huge counterattack on the whole nine yards, whole enchilada here. Individual, grassroots, taking it on personally for one's child or for one's family, and et cetera, that has to be done, true. But we need a larger, organized effort to bring attention to this and all the harm and all of the almost like death by a thousand cuts that people are experiencing. And one, we certainly recognize that the media and the other people who are pushing this war on us is not going to help us, not going to put up the funds necessary to mount a awareness campaign, to mount a campaign to put pressure on school boards, to put pressure on state legislatures, governors, and in Washington, Senate, the Congress, the White House. That's what it's going to take to bring this, to make this issue a public issue to be dealt with immediately. And I hope, and that's one of the reasons why I was all over doing this show on the subject, is because I hope we can ignite dialogue, discussion, ignite awareness, understanding, and then rally and the troops, or I'll recruit the troops and rally the troops to mount a very effective war, a response to the war, that will have a chance of making a difference.
Well,
now,
one thing
a lot
that
coming from me, I said a lot, so it may be more than people wanted to hear, but that's all I have to say about the matter.
I think my personal experience on it, with getting the word out about dyslexia, I actually did an interview with a local newspaper, I guess almost a year ago, and it was actually about the SAT-10 testing, our K-2 testing, standardized testing that we were doing. But I had mentioned that, you know, my daughter has dyslexia, and it kind of, it was like a 50-50 interview at that point. The article was actually about the SAT-10, but it was mostly about dyslexia. It kind of came out. And I actually had parents look me up through Facebook to say, my daughter's going through the same thing, or my grandchild's going through the same thing. You know, can you help? And so I've had a lot of people do that. And so the media, another local newspaper has done, the month of October is actually Dyslexia Awareness Month. And they did, one of the reporters, her name is Sally Apsher, she did an article every single week in the month of October about dyslexia. And again, more people were coming and looking me up and sending me emails saying, you know, this sounds like my child too, where they didn't know what it was, but their child was struggling in school and that nobody could figure out what was wrong. So I think I've also, and actually I've also done a couple news on one of our local news channels. They've interviewed me about dyslexia as well. So I think it's, like Eileen said, it's starting to happen. You know, I think it's just more and more people, they just don't know what dyslexia is. And I think that if we can get that out, what it is, that will definitely make a difference. It already has. It already has.
And so we can take what you're saying about dyslexia and we can continue to sort of follow that same pattern with our broader message of fighting for public education in general and for our students in general as well. And I'd like to just take a moment right now and say that we've got some fabulous activists that are having a conference in Florida this month here in about, what, 15 days, James? We've got the opt-out group with Peggy and Seresta. I know Anthony Cody is going to be down there speaking. Stephen Krashen is going to be down there. Lots of great people, amazing activists that are going to be speaking about many different things, advocating for our students. I also know that we have just had NPE launch today their conference, which is going to be in Chicago, April 25th and 26th, and then the welcome gathering is going to be on the 24th. And I know that there will be some topics and some panels and some keynote speakers there that are going to be talking about these issues and how we can work together as different grassroots activists, parent advocates, teachers, board members, politicians, everyone in the community, all the vested stakeholders coming together and presenting on how we can unite and really push back against these Machiavellian agendas on our students and how we can focus on their needs. And basically that, in a nutshell, is giving teachers autonomy and proper training and proper pay and compensation and not just filling our schools, especially our schools with the most neediest children, the at-risk children, the fall-through-the-cracks children, with temporary teachers that look nothing like them. And that is a huge problem. So I know that we will be talking about those things at later dates as well, but we've just got to support these organizations. We've got to support the independent radio stations like the War Report with Dr. Miller. We also have Just Let Me Teach with Justin Oakley. We also have Tim Sakar with Busted Pencils. We also have Cynthia Liu with her K-12 network. She's amazing as well as far as working with minority media outlets and groups. And if we can all come together as teachers, parents, media, and really work in solidarity and make it truly about taking back our schools for our students democratically, then I think that we'll have a fine chance of pulling that pin out of the grenade and having it, the house of cards all topple down. Let's support the organization.
That was cool from my point of view.
Thanks, man.
Any other comments?
Follow that.
Well, come on. Is there any other comments?
No.
What do you think? Not really. You guys, you're co-president of Speak. You guys do a lot of speaking, so you guys know what it's like to interact with all of these different types of people, not just about dyslexia, but about other issues as well. You guys have lots of stuff going on in Knoxville.
Yes, we do. Yeah, it's, you know, a lot of it about, you know, the standardized testing for sure. That's definitely a huge issue.
And you spend time talking to your Board of Education members and also students that are liaisons to the Board of Education and Knox, work with and talk about what students need as well, right?
Yes, and I think, you know, Word Speak is relatively new, and but I do think that, you know, we had definitely had an impact, you know, especially with their school board. You know, and I think that, you know, changes are coming. It's slow. It's happening slowly. But I think that it, for at least in Knox County, you know, changes will be in place soon.
Well, I think that Knox County is definitely a model, and Speak is a model of grassroots organization for people across the U.S. The things that Speak is doing is unique and definitely working. So I think we definitely need to see more of that, the conversation, the dialogue, and the advocating for students and the helping students advocate for themselves like your child did, giving them their voices.
Let me ask a question that I wanted to ask earlier. Are there national organizations? I know we do have some national organizations, but how many do we have that are seeking to bring this issue to light for the public? And what is the possibility of those national organizations as well as regional, local organizations coming together and developing a strategy and a platform to bring this issue, not just dyslexia again, I'm going at the big one, in terms of special needs, learning disability, special ed, those larger all-encompassing concept, bring that together and make it an issue for 2016. That's what I'm doing this year, is trying to gear up, bring people together for the sole purpose of putting us on the political agenda at all levels, from school board to state legislatures to mayors to governors to state senators, whatever the structure is in a given state, to U.S. Congress, the president, and the Senate, to make our issue of the war that's being waged on us a national issue, so that everyone who's running to keep their seat and running for a new election has to deal with us, make this a national issue.
We have a lot of different grassroots groups that are lobbying and that plan on doing that. Teacher associations are really amping up and working on those things as well. I think we're going to see a lot of people coming together and doing those things. As individuals.
Now, Lucy, I'm talking about making this area, special ed, a plank.
Right. Well, it should be already with the IDEA Act. I mean, it should be. I mean, theoretically, you know, it should be there already in place in Washington. That's what IDEA was all about for special needs students. But that's come under fire, and I haven't done as much research on that as I need to, but I do know that those things are changing as well. So that's something that we can go back and look at, is the IDEA law, and see what's up with that and how SPED is being affected now.
Okay. We have 2 minutes left, so everyone chime in for 30 seconds to carry us out to the end.
Well, 2015 is the year of the student, and that's the hashtag that we're going to be using. And everyone, keep your eyes out for our next show, which is January the 11th. We're going to have some very special, fun guests, and we're going to be launching our War Report blog. So, James, that's exciting. And thank you again for being on the show, to our guests, all of our guests.
Thank you for having us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, we need to get together again a little later on. That's part of pushing the awareness button. Okay, so this is not a one-night stand, using that old slogan, all right? Let's make this a relationship. That we push it. We push it. We come together and we push it, and we make it something that everyone has to be aware of and has to deal with. Okay. That's my goal, and that's how I think the war report can help. So with that and all of the difficulties we had, because we had such a large platform and a large panel of guests, people who couldn't get in, I'm reading now the people that I know who were sending me PM saying that they tried to get in, could get in. You'll have an opportunity later, because we're not going to make this a one-night stand. We're going to really turn this into a relationship with a campaign pushing us. So with that, I too thank everyone for participating today and starting the dialogue, the conversation, and what a way to kick off 2015. So with that, I'm going to say goodbye because our time is up, and we will get together again very, very soon. And Happy New Year to everyone who hung in here with us. Network,
Happy New Year.
Take us out. Happy New Year.
Join us again next time. Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.